From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump says he has asked Turkey for those audio and video recordings, if they exist, of the suspected murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul earlier this month. Turkish officials have now published what they say is heard on the tapes in state-backed media. The New York Times says the gruesome details confirm a murder. And despite Turkish officials saying it was the Crown Prince's agents who tortured and dismembered Khashoggi, who lived and worked in the U.S., in the Oval Office this morning, Trump defended his support of the Saudis.
I'm not giving cover at all. With that being said, Saudi Arabia has been a very important ally of ours in the Middle East.
Also on President Trump's mind, the midterms, just 20 days away. Last night, Trump said he won't accept blame if his party loses the House. Lots to talk about with our political strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democrat and host at Hill TV. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And Jamal, what do you think, first of all, how important is how Trump responds to this alleged murder of Jamal Khashoggi? And of course, we remember, and Trump just said it right there, the U.S. has a big relationship economically and politically with Saudi Arabia.
It's incredibly important. I mean, one of the things that's been quite disturbing to me over the last couple of years is how the president has pulled America back from some of its international relationships, but then also pulled back from talking about American values when you go around. And I spent a lot of time earlier in my career traveling the globe and on behalf of the government, on behalf of private organizations. And, you know, I always felt the security that if something happened to me, the United States government would be there to help ride to the rescue. I just think if you're working for an international organization in some part of the world today, you don't feel that level of security you may have felt 6 months ago.
Because Khashoggi was a U.S. resident.
Right. Well, but Alice, you know, how would you advise?
He was a U.S. resident, also working for an American newspaper.
Right.
Which President Trump hates. He hates that newspaper, the Washington Post.
Well, that shouldn't matter, right?
Well, there you go. But Alice, how would you advise Republicans at this moment? The Crown Prince had other moments. You know, he detained Saudi billionaires in a hotel.
There's the war in Yemen.
Here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox and Friends just yesterday about Mohammed bin Salman.
This guy's got to go. Saudi Arabia, if you're listening, there are a lot of good people you can choose, but MBS has tainted your country and tainted himself.
Like who?
And Alice, is this tainting Trump? Because there's a whiff of the fact that he has personal relations with the Saudis. His son-in-law and daughter, you know, have potential business deals with them. And he's starting to feel like it's more personal than for the good of the country or for human rights.
Robin, unfortunately, it feels as though there's a little bit more than a whiff of connection between the president and the first family and these Saudi officials, which is a big concern. I do think it is critical for us to get all of the information before we make any big declarations. I wish there was a little bit more of Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump when he's talking about this situation in the fire and fury that we do hear in Lindsey Graham's voice. But the president is right in that Saudi Arabia is important business interest for the United States, $450 billion worth of business interest, $110 billion with regard to military purchases. But if things go as all indications are that this was a brutal, brutal killing, then clearly we need to take drastic steps and really make a point. This is a human rights issue, and this is about what is right for our country and setting an example that this kind of behavior is simply not tolerated.
Jamal, if this is on the minds of voters in a few weeks, is that good for Trump or bad for Trump?
It would be bad for Trump, but I doubt that it will be on the minds of voters. Voters are usually concerned with things that are happening much closer to home, not just their pocketbooks, but also, can their kids Google the President of the United States and the First Lady and not have to have the parent filter on their computers when the results come back? I think that there's a real values problem with the president, not just how he interacts abroad, but also the values that he espouses as the president and his desire to win at all costs. Regardless of how you perform, the things he said about Stormy Daniels, the things he said about Dr. Blasey Ford, it's just a really tough time to admire the president of the United States. And I think that will matter along with the other issues.
Well, but Alice, you know many people do. And so as you know, let's head into the midterms with another issue. First of all, just as we put Khashoggi behind us, this notion that those tapes might come out. So that's hovering over everything. The Turks say they have these audio tapes of the actual murder, and they sound grisly. But then there's the deficit. The Treasury Department reported this week that the U.S. budget deficit grew to $779 billion under President Trump. His critics, as you know, Alice, are blaming the tax cut. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blamed rising federal deficits on social programs. Let's listen.
It's very disturbing, and it's driven by the three big entitlement programs that are very popular, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. That's 70% of what we spend every year.
Alice, that was from Bloomberg TV, by the way. How popular is that going to be when people figure out what entitlement programs are?
Well, I think clearly, if they are affected, and if we do have to make cuts with regard to those programs, it will have an impact, I believe, on voters. And Democrats can certainly use that as a message to fight against Republicans. But I'd like to think that between the unemployment rate at historic lows, and we have job numbers are at an all-time high, and we're having more confidence in the economy, those kind of barometers with regards to jobs in the economy will have more of an impact, at least when we're talking about the midterms, more short term. Long term, yes, when we're getting closer to 2020, that might be an issue. But people right now are looking at, do I have a job? Am I making more money than I made last year or 2 years ago? Right. And how am I comfortable with regard to putting money away for a rainy day? And right now, it looks as though more people are feeling more confident in their individual paychecks, which will be beneficial to
Republicans. But Jamal, where is the Democrat making the case that the reason that the deficit is so big is largely because of this huge tax cut that was supposed to pay for itself?
Here I am, right here.
Sorry, we got to go. Thank you.
That's exactly right. We just passed a tax cut that put billions of dollars back into the hands of the wealthiest people. We're borrowing that money from the Chinese, which was in the Saudis and all the other people around the world who are buying American debt. And that you can't tell me that doesn't matter as we begin to negotiate some of these issues around the world. And I got to tell you, the Republicans always run a jobs program. It's called the Defense Department, because that money doesn't just go to taking care of troops. It also goes to all the defense contractors who are being paid in lots of Republican districts. I think this is we got to look at the broader budget, and I will tell you, if Donald Trump wants to start cutting entitlements, he should call George W. Bush and ask how that went for him when he started talking about reforming Medicare and Social Security.
Look again with an eye on the upcoming elections. In their second and possibly final debate, the Texas Democrat Beto O'Rourke really came out on the attack against the Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who is seeing a bump in some polls. But O'Rourke called Cruz dishonest for saying he supported a $10 a barrel tax on oil. Here's Cruz's response.
Well, it's clear Congressman O'Rourke's pollsters have told him to come out on the attack. So if he wants to insult me and call me a liar, that's fine. But, you know, John Adams famously said, facts are stubborn things.
Now, O'Rourke did once vote for an oil tax that never became law. But O'Rourke was able to use Donald Trump's own words against Cruz last night. Just your thoughts, Alice, on what would you advise as a strategist?
Well, first of all, look, clearly O'Rourke is resorting to name-calling instead of looking at the record. When he spent three times as much as Ted Cruz, and he's still behind by 10 points in the polls. And I was Ted Cruz's communications director in the 2016 campaign, right, and I can still hear lying Ted in my head.
Right. But you heard it last night.
Exactly. That's right. And here's the thing. If you look at the issues that are important to people of Texas, Beto O'Rourke doesn't represent those issues. He's for government-funded late-term abortion, socialized medicine, open borders, and he's advocating for wind and solar energy in Texas, of all places. So what people saw last night was a candidate that clearly he might get a lot of media attention and has a lot of money, but his values are not reflective of Texas. And at the end of the day, Republicans and the people of Texas will come home to someone that has represented them well with their values, and that's Ted Cruz. And that's what we'll see in a lot of these Republican right. Senate races across the country.
Well, Jamal, would you recommend that Beto O'Rourke continue that, swinging, coming out swinging? What would you say?
Certainly he should come out swinging. Look, I'm not a Texan, but I did do a lot of – I lived in the South and did
you
a lot of politics
there once.
In the South. But in the South generally, although some would argue whether or not Texas is the South. That's how much right. I understand. But there's a real concern here because a lot of Americans are going through real problems like opioid abuse, and people want more care, not less care. I think that and we're talking about different populations of people. There are lots of Latino voters in Texas who I think probably care about making sure that babies aren't separated from their mothers at the border when they cross by the government. You know, there's some real issues. So Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz may be talking to two different parts of Texas.
Jamal, just quick, do you think that it was silly that Elizabeth Warren came out with her DNA test with just a few weeks before the election?
It certainly seems, in retrospect, it was a little too cute by half. You know, you can't play this game with Donald Trump. Don't fall into his lair because he will never let you escape it.
She's more presidential contender in 2020 than Native American.
Alice Stewart, okay. Republican strategist, Jamal Simmons, the Democrat, host at Hill TV. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, close your eyes. When I play this, you see what? Of course, the elegantly warring teenagers from West Side Story. They are the legacy of choreographer Jerome Robbins, who also created the memorable dances in Fiddler on the Roof, Peter Pan, The King and I. But a new book makes the case that these populist pieces also kept Robbins from assuming his proper place in dance, that because he was regarded as one of the 20th century's most powerful storytellers, he was too lowbrow for the more abstract world of 20th century ballet. Second tier to George Balanchine, the great Russian-born choreographer and co-founder of the New York City Ballet, who hired a 31-year-old Robbins in 1949 to be that company's associate artistic director. Author Wendy Lesser says she's made it her vow, her sworn duty, to overturn the prevailing myth about Robbins. Her new book, Jerome Robbins, A Life in Dance, and she joins us now. Wendy Lesser, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
Just, you know, thinking of the West Side Story scenes that are now in our minds, you write a tidbit I hadn't heard that in the film version, these sharks and jets snapping their fingers are like above us. We're beneath them somehow. And that's because Jerome Robbins had trenches dug?
That's right. And if you go back and see the movie, and I have to say, although I love the ballets and I'm championing them in this book, I am not saying anything bad about West Side Story. It's a masterpiece. It's a great work. Mm-hmm. And so was Peter Pan. You know, he really was a genius in that field. It's just that because he was so good in that field, for the reasons you said, his ballets got the wrong sort or not enough attention.
Right.
Anyway, about the West Side Story filming, yes, he had trenches dug into the street. And you can actually go and see the movie again and see that you are lower than the dancers.
Right, they go over you. Fabulous. Well, yeah. So how did this all start? You were familiar with the ballet world, had certainly observed it, had written about it, and then you started writing this book for Yale University Press's Jewish Live series for the 100th centennial of Jerome Robbins' birth. Certainly knew about his works, as we all would know about West Side Story and The King and I. And then you're bowled over by something you didn't know about. I didn't either until you wrote about it. The Jerome Robbins 1971 ballet Goldberg Variations for the New York City Ballet, set to, of course, the music from Bach. Let's just listen to a little of the sound. Okay, so we will have all of the videos that we talk about here at hereandnow.org, but what are we seeing in this ballet? What did you see that really got you?
The thing is that I went to that program not ever having heard of a Goldberg Variations by Jerome Robbins. I didn't know he did a dance to it. And I went to see the West Side Story Suite, which was on the same program. And to my enormous surprise, Goldberg Variations turned out to be an incredible masterpiece, 80 minutes long, with a live pianist over on the side. Every kind of movement you could imagine standard ballet, folk style, courtly, friendly, formal. It was just an amazing range of dance. It used 30 dancers in all, and it had the feeling of the music. I can't say anything better about a piece of dance than to say that it had the feeling of Bach's Goldberg Variation. And I loved it so much I went back the following week. And then I thought, something's going on here that I don't know about. I think of him as the West Side Story man, the Peter Pan man, the Fiddler on the Roof man. But really, if he can do a ballet like this, how many others could he have done?
Right. And you even spoke to friends who said, oh, yeah, I saw that back when it first came out. And I remember really loving it and then feeling a little bad about that.
That's right. That was the impression I got. And I couldn't figure out exactly why that would be, although I knew that Robbins had a reputation as being lower than Balanchine, who was the king, the saint of ballet. And I knew that a lot of people thought because he was a Broadway guy, he couldn't really do ballet, although Balanchine never thought that. But then I read Amanda Vales and Deborah Jowett's excellent biographies, two of them, and they both mentioned in relation to Goldberg Variations that Arlene Croce had panned it.
And,
she was the most powerful dance critic and absolutely the most powerful ballet critic of her generation.
And you said you sat there stunned at the beauty of this piece for however many minutes. She called it 90 minutes of hard labor and also called Jerome Robbins a fretful, angry man. That was later. But you became, as you write, like a court-appointed lawyer. You were going to prove Robbins' worth as a ballet choreographer. And so let's take a listen to some of, again, the pieces, and we will have as much visual as we can at hearnow.org. Afternoon of a Faun, 1953, to the music of Debussy. We'll link you to the 1955 Canadian TV taping of it with the original ballerina, Tanaquil Leclerc, Tanny, Robbins' muse and dear friend. And this is a year before she was paralyzed by polio. Is this a reimagining of the Afternoon of a Faun?
Well, I just love this dance, and it's only about 12 minutes long. You can watch it over and over, and it just feels wonderful every time. It's not just a reimagining of the music, but a reimagining of Nijinsky's version that he did in the very beginning of the 20th century. The Faun is the main character, and he has priestesses dancing around him and stuff, but he's practically a solo. Whereas Robbins imagined this as a duet, a wonderful duet, I think, where it's simultaneously about the ballet world. We're looking at two dancers in a studio, partly, and then it's also about a faun and his dream girl who comes and visits him. And with those two dancers, Tanaquil Leclerc and Jacques d'Amboise, it was a knockout.
And what are they? They're like, they're watching themselves in a practice mirror?
That's what it feels like, and we are the mirror. They're looking toward us out in the audience, but they seem to be looking in a mirror, as dancers sometimes do in a studio, so that there's this weird feeling of we're spying on them in a way. And Balanchine himself never took this superior attitude toward things that had a plot. Balanchine loved Dances at a Gathering, which Robbins made, and Balanchine said it was so great, he should make more. It's like popcorn, he said. Like you could eat it, the whole thing, endlessly.
Oh, popcorn, that's probably drove others, you know, off the cliff. But let's listen to a little of Dances at a Gathering. This is the dance Robbins created to Chopin music in 1969. He had been away from the New York City Ballet doing choreography for Broadway. But this, Dances at a Gathering, was an instant hit. Let's listen to a little of it. And what do we see in this dance?
Dances at a Gathering starts with a young man alone on stage and sort of ends up with him touching the stage after many, many minutes. It's quite a long ballet of all the dancers coming in and joining him, and they all get to strut their stuff and they combine in many different ways. But the idea is they are dancers hanging out together. And so one of the things Jerome Robbins did is have them stand at the side, watching each other as others are dancing. It's, again, like Afternoon of a Faun, a combination of a work that's meant for us and that it's meant to have a real worldly reality and a work that talks about itself being on the stage.
Hmm. You talk about his childhood, which was difficult, fraught relationship with his mother, and he became difficult. There's a famous in dance circle story about him backing up on stage during rehearsal. You know, he has his back to the audience. The company's in front of him. He's backing up, and no one tells him that he's coming at the edge, and he falls into the orchestra pit, and no one comes to help him.
Right.
He, you know, could be cruel.
Yes, and a lot of people talk about his cruelty, and there are many, many stories about how difficult he was, and not just to the dancers, to Leonard Bernstein, for instance, when they were rehearsing West Side Story in Washington in a theater, and Leonard Bernstein was sitting there near the front of the theater listening to them play his music, and Robbins comes tearing down the aisle and says to the orchestra, cut out that Hollywood crap, and basically reworks the music with Bernstein in the room. Bernstein was so upset he had to leave. He went to a bar across the street. So Robbins was not a nice guy to a lot of people, but the dancers that loved him still love him. I've talked to some of them, and I kind of felt writing the book, I came to love the ballet so much that I loved him too. Not his person, because I never met him, but I wanted people to finish the book feeling this in some ways was a pretty great guy with very deep feelings and an enormous intelligence, even if he did a lot of unpleasant things.
Well, and they included, by the way, naming names to Joseph McCarthy's House Un-American Affairs Committee, the communist witch hunt of the 1950s. He did it because he was afraid of being outed as being gay, and he struggled over that he had done that.
He did. He felt guilty about it for decades, but it still was a pretty bad thing to do. And many of my friends reading this book in its draft version said, I didn't know if I could ever forgive him for that testimony, but you kind of won me over, you know.
There's much to like when you read. Wendy Lesser, author of the new book, Jerome Robbins, A Life in Dance. Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
On Monday, the Treasury Department reported that the federal deficit increased 17% in the fiscal year that ended in September to $779 billion. The deficit is the difference between what the government takes in and what it spends in just one year. And today, President Trump was asked about whether spending will be reined in after the midterms.
Well, I will tell you that I'm having a cabinet meeting in a little while, and we're going to ask every secretary to cut 5% for next year.
Claire Sebastian is CNN business correspondent. She joins us from New York. Claire, is that proposal to cut cabinet budgets by 5% going to go anywhere? The president has tried to get his cabinet to cut things before, and it hasn't.
Well, I mean, this has to be approved by Congress, and right. He said before he wants to do this after the midterms, when presumably we'll have a bit of a new picture when it comes to Congress. So it's not clear if that would go anywhere, and it's also not clear, Jeremy, that gets to the root cause of the problem here. Spending among government agencies, particularly non-military ones, actually some of them decreased last year rather than increasing. The big increases in spending that we saw were in interest on the debt that the government has. Obviously, that is going up as the government borrows more to fund its spending plans, Social Security and defense, where we've seen a bipartisan agreement on increasing spending. So I think it's going to be a tough sell, but certainly if he manages it, it might help reduce the deficit a little bit.
There is just one other thing that may be contributing, and actually Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell left it out of what he had to say as well on Bloomberg News.
It's very disturbing, and it's driven by the three big entitlement programs that are very popular, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. That's 70% of what we spend every year.
McConnell did not mention the $1.5 trillion Republican tax cuts. that Republicans said would pay for themselves, but clearly they haven't.
They haven't. This is an interesting one. The Republicans are saying it's not just the president and Mitch McConnell. We've heard it from the Treasury Secretary as well, that this is due to spending, which is largely driven by the Democrats. But actually, if you look at the numbers, spending, yes, it went up 3%, but government tax receipts were flat and they should have been going up. This is a strong economy where people would be paying more taxes. And, you know, there were some increases in individual and self-employment taxes, which were driven by economic growth. But the bottom line is the corporate tax cut essentially canceled that out. So we have a situation where tax receipts are flat despite this booming economy, and that really can only be attributed to the GOP tax cut.
What about the tariffs? Are they helping out at all to be charging a fee basically on all the goods coming in, for example, from China?
So there is a section that the Treasury pulls out called customs duties and excise taxes. And they did say that the very fractional increase in tax receipts that we saw in fiscal 2018, that was partly due to an increase in those duties. That may or may not be due to the tariffs. It's difficult to know exactly, but certainly that's potentially a positive sign. But there's another part of this, Jeremy, when you look at the role of the trade war, particularly with China, is that China is still the U.S.'s biggest foreign creditor, the biggest foreign owner of U.S. government bonds. So the more the U.S. borrows, the more it's paying to countries like China in interest.
Right. So it works both ways. Just quickly, 17% increase overall in the deficit. When was the last time we saw something like that?
So that kind of percentage jump, while certainly it's a big one for this year, is not entirely unusual. In 2015, when we saw the U.S. Deficit hit a low that we hadn't seen since 2007, it jumped more than 30% into 2016. Oh, okay. But I think the point is, this is a booming economy. We don't usually see deficits widen.
Yeah. Claire Sebastian, CNN business correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
Every president since Jimmy Carter has voluntarily released his tax returns to the public, but Donald Trump has not. Here's Trump on 60 Minutes after he was elected in November 2016.
At the appropriate time, I will release them. But right now, I'm under routine audit. Nobody cares. The only one who cares is, you know, you and a few people that asked that question. Obviously, the public didn't care because I won the election very easily.
Some Democrats have been pushing to get Trump's tax returns released. Here's Democratic Congressman Bill Pascrell speaking in Congress in April.
I call on the chairman of Ways and Means to stop delaying and get Mr. Trump's tax returns now.
The Democrats' efforts have been sidelined by Republicans being in control. But if the Democrats win a majority in the House in November, it means they could get Trump's tax returns. Joining us to explain is George Yin, who's a professor of law and taxation at the University of Virginia School of Law and former chief of staff of the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is this law? Who is allowed to ask for the president's tax returns?
The law authorizes the chair of any one of three tax committees in Congress to request the tax return information of any person or any business and directs the Secretary of the Treasury to furnish the information that's requested. Upon receipt, the committee must examine the information in a confidential manner, but it can appoint agents such as staff or outside experts. The law doesn't specify, but I think given the significance of the possible action by the House or the House Committee, it would probably be very wise for the House, the full House, first to pass a resolution authorizing the committee chair to make this request and to be very clear on what the legislative purpose of this is.
And it would just require the Democrats taking the House to do this. They wouldn't have to take both the House and the Senate.
That's exactly right. So either committee or any of the committees can act unilaterally. And so if the Democrats simply took the House, not the Senate, the House committee could proceed on its own. Similarly, the Senate could proceed on its own if the opposite situation were to occur.
So if the House Ways and Means Committee were to get those tax returns, does that mean the public is going to be able to see them?
Well, there is a further provision in the law that allows the committee, after completing its investigation, to submit any of the information that it's obtained to the full House or the full Senate. And presumably it would be by some kind of committee vote the committee would resolve to do this. Now, again, the law doesn't specify, but I think sound practice would say that there should be some reason why the committee feels it needs to share this more broadly beyond simply the committee and its staff.
What kind of reason could you think of?
Well, you know, there are any number of reasons. It really depends a little bit on what the initial investigation to start out with is. This is a tax committee, and so it certainly could be a legitimate reason to examine because the committee has oversight over the tax function. The long history going back 40 years in this country has been that every president has voluntarily turned over his tax returns. And, you know, there is a good public purpose, if you will, for that. And so the committee could be carrying that out. Beyond that, obviously, there have been stories. The New York Times had a story about some of the tax filing, prior tax filing by Mr. Trump's father. And there have been, obviously, issues about potential conflicts of interest.
The New York Times also raised the possibility of fraud in that story.
Yes. Well, I mean, again, I would think that, you know, it's up to the committee to, and the House to decide what exactly it's doing and why it's searching it. But I think I could come up with some very legitimate arguments, purposes for the committee to take this action.
What is the history of this law? It goes back to 1924, the law that allows the House to do this, to get somebody's tax returns.
Yeah. So it is almost a 100-year-old law. And the circumstances when it came about were actually fairly close to our current circumstances. The law prior to this law allowed only the president to make a decision of whose tax information could be disclosed. At that time, when that law was in effect, it frustrated Congress in the early 1920s. There were a variety of reasons. Two principal ones were they were carrying out a number of investigations of the executive branch, including the scandal that became known as the Teapot Dome scandal involving some high-level executive branch officials. The committees that were investigating wanted to examine their tax returns, and because of the law, they had to actually go to the president and request permission from the president to get the tax material, even though they were investigating, you know, executives under the president. And so, obviously, Congress realized, gee, we're not really a co-equal branch of government if we have to go through this kind of procedure. There was a similar concern about Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, who was an extremely wealthy and successful business person prior to going into government, and like the president, did not surrender or place in blind trust his business interests, but simply retained them while he was in office. And that obviously then raised all sorts of questions in Congress's mind. The Coolidge administration at that time was pushing through various tax legislation, just like the existing administration pushed through at the end of last year. And there were issues of, well, how would this legislation affect you personally? How would it affect your businesses? You know, so there was all of that going on, and Congress ultimately decided to be a co-equal branch of government. It needed to have the authority to get this information directly, just as the executive branch already had.
Do you think that if President Trump's tax returns are released in some way, if the Democrats take the House and they're able to get them, that people who want to see them will be satisfied with what they see? Because what are we really going to learn from them?
Well, that's a tough question because obviously it depends on what people want to see. And I can't really say that people will be satisfied without knowing exactly what people want to see. I would think as a policy matter, you'd want to see, you know, somebody who, for example, is very honest in their tax filing because that goes to the character of a person. Let's make sure that you first did file returns, did pay taxes, and paid more or less the right amount of tax.
But if President Trump, for example, took a big loss on real estate in 1 year and didn't pay taxes for 10 years after that, that would be, as he's been saying, legal. It may not look good, to some, but it also might not prove anything that people don't already know about him.
Right. So I agree with that. I mean, what I've been thinking about more is in terms of character is simply complying with the law. Mm-hmm. I think another area that would be fairly obvious to me would be the possibility of conflicts of interest. We know that the president has a lot of authority to undertake various relationships on behalf of the country. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what are those decisions? And is there some personal or business interest on the part of some of the decision-making going on? I would think that would be a very legitimate inquiry on the part of a number of people in the public. And if they wanted to know that, well, that would be something that might come out from an examination of the returns.
And I would add one more thing, which is whether he actually made as much money as he said he did. We would find that out in terms of his yearly income.
Yeah, although I think that, you know, you need to be a little cautious about that, because if a tax return typically doesn't really show the amount of income the way you and I might, or the member of the public might think of, that is, you know, how rich you are and how much and so forth, because a lot of that income of that sort doesn't actually translate into taxable income. And so the return may not really show, I mean, it may show a relatively modest amount of taxable income. And in fact, as you say, it may show little or no taxes paid. That doesn't necessarily mean that he actually isn't a very rich person. So you have to kind of be a little careful about that.
That's George Yin, who is a professor of law and taxation at the University of Virginia School of Law and former chief of staff of the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. George Yin, thanks again.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today, anywhere you go in Canada, recreational marijuana is legal. Canada has become the second country in the world after Uruguay to make marijuana legal. But it's a far bigger country, and rules on where to buy and consume vary. Activist Ian Power was among the first to purchase it legally at a store in St. John's, Newfoundland.
Who else gets to make history like this? We just did it. We finally did it. All the years of activism have paid off in this one single epic moment. I'm going to frame it and hang it on my wall. I'm not even going to smoke it. I'm going to save it forever. It's going to be vacuum sealed and put on the wall.
Paola Loriggio is a reporter with the news agency Canadian Press. She's in Toronto. So, Paola, some marijuana apparently is going to be framed on the wall, others using it. Canada has had medical marijuana since 2001. This is recreational across the country. How's it going?
Well, people have been waiting for this for quite some time. There's been quite a bit of activism. And in fact, our federal government campaigned on this several years ago. There's been people who, as you heard, went to buy in various places at midnight. But the problem is, depending on where you are, the rules are different as to where you can buy, where you can consume. So even though it's legal across the country, there are still things to be mindful of depending on where you are.
Well, Canada has 10 provinces, 3 territories. And as you said, the rules vary. And are there, you know, cities or territories that are against this, that are trying to maybe push back against it with their own restrictions?
There are definitely some jurisdictions that are being more conservative with their rules. Provincially, that's taken the form mainly of restricting where you can consume. There's some provinces where you can only consume cannabis in your own home, for example, whereas a lot of others are making it kind of like smoking cigarettes, where wherever smoking is legal, then you can smoke marijuana as long as you're not near children or, you know, at the wheel of a car or something like that. What we've yet to see is what municipalities will do, because in a lot of provinces, municipalities are being given the power to enact even more stringent rules. And that has yet to play out. I think we'll see that in the next few months, how various local governments respond.
Yeah, we saw that happen here in Colorado, for instance. There began to be concerns about how close a cellar could be to a school. So I'm sure some of that's going to unfold. But we understand that in provinces without a regulated retail framework, Canadians can purchase marijuana online, but it has to be from a federally licensed producer, and there has to be secure home delivery. You have to be at least 18 and older in Canada to buy recreational marijuana starting today, but some provinces have made the age 19.
Mm-hmm. So 18 is the baseline that's set out in the federal law. But provinces are given the power to, you know, raise that age if they want to. And a lot of them have aligned it with what their legal drinking age is. So in a lot of provinces, that's 19. There's a few that have kept it at 18. So we're going to see a lot of those same variations that there are for consuming drinking alcohol.
Yeah. And how much can you buy and how much can you grow now that it's legal?
So under the federal law, you can have up to 30 grams of dried cannabis or equivalent in non-dried. You can grow up to four plants per home for personal use. But again, those are all things, at least the number of plants, that can be restricted further by provinces. And there are a few that have said that you actually can't grow any for yourself.
Well, see, a huge difference in Canada is that this is a federal law, and the government itself, the government of Canada, is going to oversee the production, manufacturing. So the fact that the federal government is involved means that banks can be involved. Here in the United States, it's the states that are allowing it one by one, but the federal government still outlaws it. So banking, causes a big problem with what to do with the money that flows from it. This doesn't seem like it's going to be a problem in Canada.
There's a huge spotlight on the marijuana market in Canada. There has been for quite some time. It is looking like it's going to be big business. The stocks have all been kind of skyrocketing up until today. Today, you know, it's a bit of a shaky start, and we don't really quite know how that's going to play out. There's a lot of fears about a marijuana bubble, because, you know, while there are estimates as to what the market is going to look like, we actually don't really know what the demand is yet. Yeah. And so I think there's going to be quite a lot of attention on that in the coming months and years.
What about the black market? Is that going to cut into the now legal market?
That was the idea behind legalization, was to kind of stamp out the black market, or at least find a way to bring people who were selling marijuana into a legal market, a legal framework. Whether or not that will be completely eradicated remains to be seen, and especially when there are kind of question marks as to the regulations and where stores and just access to marijuana will be. In Ontario, I know that there's a possibility for municipalities to refuse to have any kind of cannabis stores on their property. And there's been some concern that that could allow some pockets of the black market to still thrive in those areas.
Well, last thought. Americans, don't get any ideas. You cannot bring it across the border. It's still illegal to do that. Paola Origio, a reporter with the news agency Canadian Press. Paola, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.